So, I'm sitting here with Satchadarka and Sarvananda in their living room. I thought I might start by asking you how you came to be here in this room now, living in this house.
How many years have we lived together?
Well, I think it must be about 18 years we've lived together in one form or another.
Yep.
First of all, we were in a small community together with various people changing, but we can't go into all the details, but I mean, you know, a small community. Then we moved that community into a big community, which was Maitri Kula, above the old centre in Norwich. And we were there for a fair few years.
Yep.
Don't really know how long it was. And then when that community closed because the city council wanted the building, or they wanted us to pay more than we wanted to pay for it, so we gave up the lease, and the community disbanded, but Sarvananda and I decided to live together on our own. So then we moved just up the road to Whitehall Road, and we were there for 2 years, I think. And then I had a house in Croydon, and I decided to sell it, which had been rented out, and I sold it and bought this house, and we moved two streets down to here. And that was, I think, that was about 9 years ago. So we've been here 9 or 10 years now.
Yeah.
But before that, we were there. So we've been together on our own for about 12 years.
Yeah. Seems fairly easy. We have a definite kind of routine. When I'm not working at the centre, I'll work in the mornings and then I'll leave to go swimming so that Satchadarka can play his saxophone in the afternoon. We have dinner together, lunch together sometimes, breakfast together.
And when you say you work in the morning...
I work out of my writing in the morning. Yeah. So it's a fairly consistent routine, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Well, I live a kind of double life because I also live with Satchagita. I'm at her house quite a lot. I haven't worked it out, but I mean, it must be. Sometimes it's about as much as half the week, I think, but it's not sort of a timetable or anything. So yeah. We've got our routine here, and I've got a non-routine at Satchagita's. And she comes here sometimes as well.
Yeah, the two of us actually get together every Thursday evening just to have a chat and things, don't we?
Watch a movie. We scheduled that weekly, definite meeting. Sort of. It's like a community meeting, isn't it?
Your community night.
That's right. Yeah. I think at one point we did try and do some cleaning, but it didn't last very long.
No. Yeah. Well, the place doesn't get dirty, does it?
No.
But we hoover it once a year, whether it needs it or not.
So, do you remember when you first met?
Yeah, I do.
I think I first saw Satchadarka at Vajraloka, but I don't think I talked to you. You were in a very different shift, weren't you?
Yeah.
So I think that's the first time I was aware of you, and then you came on an arts retreat. You hadn't been in the arts retreats for a while because you were in Croydon, and they were a bit suspect, weren't they? In Croydon.
Yes, they were, yeah. It was run by people who weren't sorted out.
That's right, yeah. So, it was an arts retreat. And I remember Satchadarka doing this poem, which kind of was hilarious. And I thought, this is a very strange and interesting bloke. I wanted to get to know him, yeah.
Well, I remember Sarvananda at Vajraloka, but because I was on the evening team or night shift, so halfway through the retreat, I just kind of imploded because I just reverted to night shift, so I was getting up at 12 o'clock and going to bed at 4 a.m. I just couldn't shake it. That's what he meant when he said I was on a different shift. So,
when you say you were used to being on night shift, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about my time at Hockney's in the evening team. We called ourselves the evening team. We were really the night team because we were on night hours. So I used to go to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning and get up at midday. That was my routine for many years. When I went on retreat, I used to try and shift it, but sometimes I couldn't shift the pattern. And on that meditation retreat, Vajraloka, that I went on, as I say, I reverted to night hours, and so I didn't see many people. You know, I didn't coincide with people in the shrine very much. But I didn't really meet Sarvananda properly, because we were in silence anyway at Vajraloka, until a couple of years later when I went on this my first performing arts retreat at Water Hall, and Sarvananda was one of the people running it. And my first memory of him was doing one of those, a drama game with him, when we had to contradict each other. So you had to sort of say what you'd done this morning, and then the other person, so you'd say, oh, well, I got up and I brushed my teeth and I, you know, walked down the road, and the other person would say, no, you didn't. You say, no, I didn't. No, actually what happened was...
Oh, yeah, you had to change your story.
Yeah, so I remember Sarvananda, I said, well, yeah, what did you do this morning? So he said, oh, I got up, brushed with it. I said, no, you didn't. He said, no, I didn't. No, what I did was I was walking down the road and I got run over by a grass cutter.
Lawnmower.
A lawnmower, that's it. And it chopped me up into lots of tiny pieces. I just thought that was hilarious. It completely cracked me up.
I have no memory of that whatsoever.
No, well, so I've liked Savandra ever since then, really. I felt we were kindred spirits from that moment.
So when would that have been?
That was 1988.
Huh? Mm.
So that's 30 years ago.
So you weren't ordained then?
No, I wasn't then.
Right.
Not for another couple of years.
Yeah, no, I was ordained in 87, so I'd just been ordained about a year or something like that, yeah. You've got a much better memory for dates than I have, I think.
Yeah. Well,
but they were very enjoyable retreats, those arts retreats.
They were, yeah. Yeah.
COVID, I led them. And, you know, they were often kind of quite chaotic. And, but COVID has just got things on, really.
So were there quite a few of them?
Well, the first ones we did was, well, that's one of the reasons I came down to Norwich in the first place, was to work with COVID and kind of various arts people. So Bodhidharma came to Norwich as well. I came to Norwich, Steve Winner, a guy called Steve Winner, he came to Norwich. And COVID, I was at Padmaloka. And we just formed a little team to put on arts retreats. And one of the first ones we did was called a Game of Life retreat, which was based around the Wheel of Life. And Subhuti gave talks in the morning. And then we split into a couple of groups. Chintamani, he would do the kind of environment workshops. So him and his team would sort of make a kind of environment of a particular realm each day, like the Hell Realm or the Hungry Ghosts. And then there'd be a drama group that kind of would create a drama around that particular realm. And then in the evening, we'd kind of come together and enact it. So it was kind of a ritual. But very, very strong retreats. I think they were the strongest retreats I can remember. And the year after that, we did the Game of Death retreat, which was based in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So it was a kind of similar thing, except we were also making our own corpses and sort of death masks and things like that, and our own obituaries and things. It was a very strong retreat. But you weren't on either of those, were you?
No.
Yeah. There was quite a few music retreats that I didn't go on.
They were, they were a bit later. So I didn't go on a performing arts retreat till 88, that one. And then had a very positive effect on me. I really took to it. And I met all these people that I'd not met, like Savandra, Bodhidharma, Chintamani, Kovda, various others. There was about 30 people on that retreat, weren't there?
Yeah.
Maybe more.
Yeah.
And they were FWBO Arts, they were called. They ran FWBO Arts. And subsequently, they got the Arts Centre, London Buddhist Arts Centre. And they started having arts conventions there.
Yeah.
I don't know when they started, but they also were pivotal events.
Mm-hmm.
But they were a later stage. So those retreats, I went on one of them every year, I think, for about five years.
Mm-hmm.
And they bridged my time in when I got ordained. So I went on several before I was ordained, then I went on, carried on with them afterwards. And I think they had... It was that integrating that aspect of things, which I think was what was missing in my Dharma life until then, was having access to arts events like that.
Yes.
You know, participatory actual doing of arts rather than what had been in Croydon was, you know, the arts centre where you weren't encouraged to actually do art yourself. You had to worship all these past artists and these visiting dignitary artists, people. Which I did quite happily, but also I wanted to be an artist, as it were.
Mm.
And of course, if you mentioned that, you've got a right on dressing down. I was going to, that's the wrong word. It was more like you were just made to feel very stupid.
Mm.
Mm. I never got any of that. And there was always kind of in Glasgow, nobody, you know, there was never any problem with me talking about writing and things like that.
Yeah.
Just my own block, I think. I couldn't, for a number of years, I just couldn't write for whatever reason. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But my conditioning in that respect is very different from Satchidananda's.
I was wondering if we could rewind and I could perhaps ask each of you How did it start, your Dharma life? What started your seeking, or what took you along?
I think I was just very depressed and anxious and unhappy, and I was working in the C&D office in Glasgow, and just over the road was the Glasgow Buddhist Centre. So I just started to go to lunchtime meditation classes. At the same time, I got into the Iona community, kind of Christian community. I think I thought that Buddhism was a bit alien. It's a bit sort of weird, and I wouldn't be, quite be able to access it. So Christianity seemed more, or at least that kind of Christianity, that more kind of radical approach, seemed more accessible. But then eventually I realised I didn't believe in God, and I just began to become more and more uncomfortable with all the language around Christianity and martyrdom and all the rest of it. And I just got more interested in Buddhism and meditation, and just made lots of links with the people at the Buddhist Centre. I think partly it was like they just talked about books and theatre and things like that. So I did feel a kind of close connection right from the beginning with a lot of these guys up in Glasgow. And people like Ajita and Jenna Banks, there are a lot of really good people there. So I made a kind of link with them. And I'd moved into a Christian community and it didn't kind of work out. So eventually I moved into a Buddhist community and just started working a gardening business. The Buddhist gardening business, which was a bit of a kind of cowboy outfit, but it was what I needed at the time, just to kind of ground me. So that was my initial connection.
So how long was it after you walked through the door that you moved into the community and got involved in the business?
I can't remember. It was a bit hazy. Maybe about 2 years or something like that. Because I went into the Christian community first. As I say, it didn't work out. But then, then that kind of fell apart. I moved into the Buddhist community. Yeah.
Mm. Do you remember which board member you first really had a connection with?
Ajita was one of the first order members I connected with. He died, I can't remember when it was, must be about 15 years ago at least, 20 years ago. And
what was he like?
He was, he had a huge amount of energy. People really kind of looked up to him. It was, he had a, everybody, and people I think were slightly in awe of him as well. Yeah, he was kind of from a kind of working class background, but he just had loads and loads of energy, like totally into the Dharma, very and just very, very inspiring, really. And, not at all conventional order member, whatever that means. he was wild, really, as well, but just at the same time, very kind of into the Dharma and into Sangharakshita, and a very, very good teacher, very good kind of meditation teacher as well. I remember him describing the mindfulness of breathing, and he was saying well, it's a little bit like making love, and he was using all this kind of sensual imagery, and I thought, oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. He was, something quite kind of courageous and wild about him. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of people really kind of connected with him. Mm. Yeah, so I think he was my kind of first real contact. Mm. Yeah.
Sajidaka?
Well, I got depressed as well. I was working after university, I was working in an office. I have, of course, gone into this in great detail in my autobiography, which is available at some good bookstores. Not many, actually. I didn't want to sort of recapitulate my written autobiography, so I'll try and tell. Say things that are not in that, which means I won't have much to say. But I did remember a good anecdote this morning, which was, this is true, that the first order member I met was Kay Maloka, who's since resigned. But I actually saw him just last weekend at Jim Islander's wake, and he was there in West London. Came like Gerald Burns, as he now is. But I had seen him since the old days, but not for ages. And someone introduced me to him again and said, "Oh, you taught this bloke how to meditate." And he said, "Oh, did it work?" And I said, "Yeah, it did." I said, "I took it up then, you know, from that day, and I've done it ever since." And he said something disparaging of himself. And I said, "I always think of you with affection." And he said, "Oh, well, that's good." And I do, because he was very funny. I told him that he made me laugh a lot. And I remembered one of the ways in which he made me laugh was when I went on a Christmas retreat in Arutara just before I moved in. And we were all going outside for a fireworks display in the garden. And he was putting on his boots, and that he was putting these absolutely enormous great boots on. And I said to him, I said, "Blimey," I said, "you've got big feet." And he said, "Well, you know what they say." And he didn't say anything more. And I found that hilarious, because I didn't realise that it was a lewd sort of joke. And he must have just thought I had a, you know, because I laughed and laughed and laughed. And he must have thought I had a very crude mind. But I just thought he was being very zen-like. I thought, you know, he was answering my question with a question. I think, you know, you've got, and he said, "You know what they say." Then I waited, but he didn't say, and that cracked me up. So, but I don't know whether he was a humorous person or not, or whether it was just me. But that's one of my best memories of him. But he taught me to meditate on that first day, and he was the first order member I met. And I remember at the end of the day, the day retreat, he said, "You know, you can meditate at home if you like, or, you know, whenever you like," and that. That was really significant that he said that. And he said, "And we have beginners classes every Wednesday, and you'd be very welcome to come to them." And I thought, "Oh, really? Well, I could come to them." And he said, "Yeah." So I did. And that was, and the rest is history.
So where was that? Was that at Arutara?
That was actually the Croydon Centre on a day retreat. That was the first thing I came to. I saw it advertised in Time Out. And I came along. Yeah. So then I, you know, came regularly to Wednesday night, and then I went to another night, you know, the regulars night, and it was all over by Christmas. I'd given up my job and moved into the community and everything. So within 6 months. But I thought that was a long time. I felt guilty that it had taken me so long. When I met Bante a bit after that, I said it took me ages to move into a community. He said, it took me about 6 months. And he said, "Well, some people take years to move into a community." So I said, "Oh, not really." So he said, "Of course, if one's very happy in one's life and one's job and everything, then there's no need to move into a community." So I said, "Oh, I wasn't happy." So he said, "Well, perhaps it's a good job that you moved in then." Yeah.
So what was it that drew you Yeah, is there more you can say about that at the risk of asking you to repeat yourself?
What the dream? One thing that I didn't mention then was that I heard on that first retreat they were listening to a taped lecture when I arrived of one of Bante's Noble Eightfold Path lectures, Perfect Speech, and that really struck me. I think, and always it was, and then I realised that they had a whole library of tapes. And I started taking them out. And I think that, more than anything, coupled with, you know, the centre that was available, I could go to, and the people I met who were friendly. But it was, I think, it, in terms of the Dharma, it was those tapes that really hooked me in. And I listened to them all. When I moved into Arutara, so it was great. They had this great chest of tapes, you know, all the Mitra study tapes and everything. And I looked at all the titles. They're fantastic titles. I got really excited by all these titles, you know, the Man's Quest for Meaning. Myth versus History, wasn't it? Man's Quest for Meaning. That was just one. And Transcendental Critique of Religion. And things like that. These titles. And I just got so excited. And I wanted to listen to more. I didn't know. And I thought, well, how do I choose which ones to listen to? I got into a real state, because I wanted to listen to them all at once. And then when I became a Mitra, I started on the Mitra study course, and then it was all mapped out. And so I relaxed, and I thought, oh, well, I'll get to hear them all. So I didn't. So I just did it, you know, one a week sort of thing.
I remember you saying that was the perfect speech. That was the first one you heard, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was.
Which you got really kind of excited about.
I did, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember what it was about that that excited you?
He talks about, it was that distinction between right speech and wrong speech. There was an acknowledgement in what he was saying of the fact that, you know, some speech is really poisonous and unpleasant and destructive. But there was another way to do it. And that, I've never heard that distinction made, but just hearing that made a huge difference. It's like it gave me a kind of an understanding of things, because I was very, didn't understand anything that happened to me. You know, I was just confused by everything. I couldn't make sense of anything. I was just overwhelmed by experience, really, and the way people were. I didn't understand it. So I needed categories, or I need someone to say, well, look, this is this and this is that. You know, this is good and this is not so good. And, you know, there's a right way to do things and a wrong way to do it. I've never heard that before, because everything was so, you know, basically you did what you liked, didn't you? I mean, there was no one ever told me, unless they told me that I shouldn't do what I wanted to do, which, you know, that does happen at school, doesn't it? But apart from that, no one ever told me why you should do this and not that and all that. Mm. So I think it was that which is basically the basics of ethics, isn't it, really? I think that was one thing that I connected with.
Mm.
And he talks about that in that perfect speech one.
Mm. Yeah. It's the perfect vision lecture that really,
yeah,
I found really engaging. And all the, you know, his reference to cosmic consciousness, which I then bought. And
book.
Yeah, mm. Has all these kind of insight experiences and visionary experiences that really excited me. Because I'd had little glimpses of things that had sent me down all sorts of strange pathways. You know, at one point, I believed I was the Messiah and things. And Ajita was very good for kind of pointing out that might not be the case. And I remember telling him about these visions that I'd had, and he just kind of pushed a couple of discipline towards me. And he said, take a couple of these and you'll be all right. He kind of downplayed it, which at the time kind of annoyed me a little bit, but I think it was what I needed to hear, really. But that kind of lecture kind of put all, you know, my experiences in context a little bit, that perfect vision lecture. And I still go back to that one. I think it's almost like a kind of template for Buddhism for me, I think.
Mm. And how did you come to ask for ordination?
I can't remember. There just didn't seem anything else to do, really. I didn't want a career. I didn't try Christianity. There was just nothing else left. And Buddhism seemed to have the answer. So just, you know, there wasn't any doubt. I think I can't remember when I asked for ordination, how long after I moved into the community and so on, but it just seemed the obvious next step. Yeah. I was, you know, even at that time I was very kind of unhappy, and I was experiencing an awful lot of difficulties, so, you know, a lot of it was just trying to get understand my dukkha and sort of go beyond it, really. Yeah. So it just seemed, you know, the inevitable next step, I think, yeah, for me.
Was there an ordination training? There wasn't an ordination training process at that point.
There was. They were called request retreats.
Request?
Request yeah. retreats, I think, which you went on and you tried to get to talk to the order members. And they were always really quite tense. I think that's why, you know, Subhuti and the rest of them, this mini revolution to make the retreats more comfortable and relaxed. They were quite difficult retreats. There was one famous retreat. There was a kind of four of us in a group, and we all got feedback, and the leaders asked us to give feedback on each other, it all got very kind of tense and unpleasant. Yeah, it was a bit strange. I mean, I didn't mind them that much, but you know, they weren't kind of relaxed affairs.
Yeah. Mm. Was it Sabuti said that, you know, there had been these request retreats, but they'd become ordination rejection retreats for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And he wanted to change. I remember him saying that in his talk on the first national gathering, as it was called, when he introduced, along with his team at Pamaloka, the new ordination process, which is basically still what they do, I think. It's still basically the same thing.
So did you go on the request retreats as well?
I went on the last request retreat. That was, I think, the beginning of 1988. Mm. And Sabuti and his lot turned up at Pamaloka, I think, more in the summer of that year and started a whole new thing, which coincided, really, with the changes in Croydon, the so-called revolution. Oh. So for me, it was like I went, everything suddenly opened up, both in Croydon and also in the wider, in the ordination process. So I'd been on the last of the old style request retreats at the beginning of that year, and I think then that and they didn't, as it happened, that they didn't do any more of them after that.
Mm.
It wasn't a terrible experience for me, but it was very different from what subsequently emerged with these themed retreats and much more can-do sort of attitude. You know, and I remember Sabuti saying to us all, you know, you'll all be ordained. All these people, we had this national gathering, all the men who'd asked for ordination who could come were there. And he talked about how the old system had got a bit problematised and that they'd become ordination rejection retreats and people had had all sorts of bad experiences. But, you know, he said, I'd like to tell you, but by asking for ordination, you've become provisional order members and you will all be ordained, but when we see that you're ready. But, you can just relax in that and get on with your practice and know that you will all be ordained one day.
Mm.
So that was a very different sort of attitude.
Yeah.
I was interested, you made the point that also happened in 1988, the year of, as you say, the so-called revolution or the changes in Croydon. Yeah. Did you sense a resonance between the before and after in both those things? In terms of how what it was like in Croydon before and on the ordination request retreat and then after. Do you see what I mean? The sort of shift.
Well, I can only speak from my own experience, and I didn't have any experience of any other centre at that point. I'd only been to Croydon and within Croydon. So, and I had been to Pamaloka a lot, but only on retreat, they're kind of different. So I don't know what it was like in the rest of the movement, but certainly, but I had heard stories about the ordination process before that. Mm. So on that basis, maybe there were... I've thought perhaps, the way Croydon was a very extreme version of certain tendencies within the movement, which were not limited to Croydon. I don't know, I can't really justify that. That's a sense I have. And maybe some of those some of those not so good tendencies were also operating in the wider movement and in the old ordination process. I don't know. Maybe there was obviously something not right about it, otherwise they wouldn't have reformed it and better organised it. But I think it's not so much that it was needed reforming, it just needed better organising, I think. They didn't have an ordination team, I think, before that. I don't know how they did it. I don't know. They had on those request retreats. I think the impression I had was it's just order members happened to turn up were on the kind of on the team. I expect it wasn't quite like that. Maybe they were invited by someone, but they weren't a team in the way that we have them now.
Hmm.
So sorry, that's a very rambling answer. It was a difficult question, really.
Yeah, no, it was just you'd mentioned that coincidence between what happened in Croydon and at Pamaloka, and I was just...
Well, certainly from that point, the things opened up in Croydon and I started going on these retreats. Mm. And that national gathering actually preceded the changes in Croydon.
Mm.
But that attitude that Sabuti was putting out there, that really much more positive attitude, did immediately affect me, and I took that back to Croydon, and it did affect me how I was in Croydon, although it was only for a few months before everything changed anyway.
Mm. I'm just wondering, so were you in Glasgow at that point still? We talked about 1988.
I was ordained in 1987, mm-hmm. and I moved down to Glasgow early in 1988. I moved down from Glasgow in early 1988, the spring of 1988.
To Norwich,
yeah. Partly, as I say, to be around Coven and Bodie Badger and various artsy people.
Mm.
But initially, I moved into Street Farm for 3 months just to have a kind of where Dharma, you know, that Dharma Mudra and Varaprava, as was, and Alaka, they all lived there. Alaka lived in his wagon. And so I moved there for 3 months just to have a place as a kind of stopgap before I got a place in Norwich.
Mm. I was just wondering whether what sense you had, whether you got wind of what was happening in these things that Satchard has been talking about, both Croydon.
I think I remember being on my ordination retreat in Spain, and Basantra, you know, telling, you know, being various kind of stirrings and things going on. And then in my first, you know, some of my first order weekends, I just remember all these kind of Croydon order members meeting Banty. And just looking really kind of stunned, and you know, a lot of them were kind of working through stuff. You know, all the, I think during that time, Padma Raja resigned. I can't remember the exact dates, but yeah, I think the first kind of inklings were on my actual ordination retreat in 87. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you more about that as well. So you were ordained at Il Convento?
No, I was in the first Cucanoca.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I just missed the Il Convento, so I was in the first week in Ulster. 1987. Yep. So that was 4 months. I shared a hut with Manjushra for 4 months, yeah. Which was quite an unusual experience because the two of us hardly had a serious conversation. We kind of created this whole light comic fantasy world between us. I think it was just a way of kind of letting off steam, and because the retreat was so intense and serious, like once we got into the hut, we just mucked about all the time. It was quite bizarre. We created this character called Frank Dolby, who was meant to come on the retreat, but was a real kind of loose cannon and wild card, and he hadn't actually managed to make it. So we invented this character, we kept talking about him, and I think a couple of other people on the retreat started believing he was real. Anyway, it was... we did have a couple of serious conversations, but it was quite unusual in that you know, we had this kind of strange, comic conversation for 4 months. Yeah.
And do you have other recollections of the retreat?
I think I found it quite difficult. I was still working through an awful lot of stuff. I had a big A3 folder that I was kind of drawing on and writing on, just kind of working through an awful lot of stuff. I'm not sure I liked Cucanoca very much in terms of the environment. I found it quite stark and austere. And I kind of longed for greenery and damp. And you know, people used to say how beautiful the scenery was, and yeah, I realised actually I'm not sure. No, it's some beautiful sunsets and things like that, but I actually found the valley a bit difficult in terms of kind of environment and geographically. So it wasn't a particularly easy retreat for me. Yeah. Banty was there, so Banty was my private and public preceptor. I really liked my name.
What is your name, mean?
Savananda. Infinite bliss, happiness, yeah.
Is that because you're a very miserable man?
Well, I think it was partly because I was a bit miserable and you know, Banty knew the fact that I'd had some difficult time, but I like to think that there was a certain amount of kind of joy there as well.
Yeah, well, I've experienced that joy, I have to say.
Yeah.
Would you say it was... been the effect of your name or your relationship with your name over time, because it's 30 years now.
Yeah, I do reflect on it from time to time. I'm really glad to have the name, you know, just to kind of remind myself that you know, there's this kind of basis of joy underneath all the kind of difficulties. So, you know, I was really pleased with the name as soon as he gave it to me. He said, "It's Sarvananda. Don't let these English order members call you Sarvananda." So I've always kind of stressed the second day. Yeah. And we had quite a few meetings with Banti, which were very good, question and answer sessions and things. Mm-hmm. So he was always there. I think he was there for maybe all of the retreat. Yeah. I can't quite remember, actually. Yeah.
Do you remember when you first met Banti?
Yes. Slightly embarrassing because I went on a solitary retreat in the Highlands and I wrote a letter to Banti, and I was basically a little bit mad, and I asked Banti if he'd be one of my disciples. And I heard later on that, you know, Banti asked one of the Glasgow Order members, "Is Alistair all right?" So my first meeting with Banti was at Padmaloka, and part of that was me just apologising for that letter, and he just smiled really. He just grinned. So, you know, it was just a very pleasant meeting. I can't remember much of what we talked about, but I just had a sense of being a disciple. Just the word disciple came up.
When you actually met with him?
Yeah. Or after the meeting, I didn't. It was the kind of word disciple that came to mind. There's another thing, I mean, we were talking about films and... Oh yeah, there's a couple of actors that I remembered in this film that Banti couldn't remember, and that kind of surprised me a bit, because I think I had a kind of naive idea that Banti was omniscient or something like that and should know everything, including the names of all the actors in the film. So it just kind of demonstrates that I was still a little bit naive and a little bit strange at that time. Yeah, but it was a very, very good meeting, my first meeting. Yeah. Mm.
Did you have more contact with him between then and when you got ordained?
Not really. I mean, I don't think I've actually met Banti that often. Maybe one-to-one. So I'm not really sure how many. Not a huge amount of time. I have written to him quite a few times, and he's often sent me really good postcards back. I once sent him a chapter of a novel which he read, and kind of responded to, sent him a couple of my plays, and he responded to that as well, which was quite kind of heartening. Yeah.
Mm. One more question, going back to your ordination. I was wondering about the practice that you took at ordination.
I took the Shakyamuni practice at ordination, and for some reason, I just couldn't connect with it. So for, I think maybe I took it with my head, like I'm a Buddhist, so I should take the Buddha as a... But for 2 years I really quite struggled with it. I didn't make much heart connection with it. And then after about 2 years, Alaka led me through the Vajrasattva practice. So I just started doing the Vajrasattva practice, and that's been my main practice ever since. Yeah.
Anything particularly about the Vajrasattva practice?
I don't know why I particularly responded to that one. Partly because he's kind of a young man, he's kind of beautiful. Something about him kind of purifying guilt, as in a kind of conditioned fear and guilt. And just being a kind of completely kind of positive figure in that way, rather than anything to do with fear of punishment and guilt. So I think that was one of the ways into Vajrasattva for me. I think partly because Alaka did it as well, and he produced these little Vajrasattva books that I have, and I had a look at the book and it was really interesting. And I think right from the beginning, I was interested in enlightenment, and the fact that Vajrasattva represents the fact that you're the Buddha already. That appealed to me. That, you know, like the kind of whole immanence model, I think, is always kind of, I've always found really kind of interesting and engaging and inspiring.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that would have been about 28 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, when I started doing the Vajrasattva practice, that's right, yeah.
Is it still?
I don't do it much at the moment, but in the evening I do a couple of mantras at the end just to kind of stay in touch.
Mm.
I've also noticed, like, I was doing the kind of feeding the demons, doing those kind of practices, and at the end of those practices a kind of positive effect for you sometimes appeared. And it wasn't always Vajrasattva in the Vajrasattva form, but it was often in the form of some kind of figure associated with Vajrasattva or connected with Vajrasattva. So I think it's, you know, I'm still kind of connected to it on some kind of level. Yeah. I've got a kind of scrapbook as well that I use, and often I have images of Vajrasattva and things. Yeah, so it's still a connection there, very much so. Yeah.
It seems like images are very important to you, although you're a writer. You've mentioned a few times about images.
I'm not an artist at all, but I do like, I think that's one of the reasons I kind of connected with Blake, is that kind of combination of word and image. Always seems like slightly disappointing that after a certain age, books don't have any pictures in them. Images are important. And as I said, like, often on retreats, especially longer ones, I do spontaneously seem to want to draw characters and draw images. And if I've been going through a difficult time, sometimes I try and characterise these kind of mental states in images. Yeah. So yeah, they are definitely important. The whole kind of Buddhist pantheon of bodhisattvas and Buddhas and ritual generally, I've tended to not always find that accessible. So puja and devotion I've always found really, really difficult, right from the word go. I don't think it's a problem anymore because it's just kind of carried on for so long. So I need to find other ways in. It's not that I can't do pujas, I don't connect with pujas, but, you know, generally speaking, I've always found them really, really difficult, the devotional ritual aspect. I think I'm a little bit willfully Western, you see what I mean, which is why the arts are so important to me, or one of the reasons.
Mm. How about you and puja?
I quite like puja.
Mm.
I don't think about it much, but whenever if I'm sort of at one, I enjoy it. But I think when I, you know, just again, when I first heard about them, that had quite a transformative effect. I mean, the fact that they exist means a lot to me. I mean, as if I had a ritual element, you know, I had a need for a ritual in my life, and I didn't have any explicit place for that before I heard about it, before it was. So a bit like just being told about it broadened my consciousness, and I have done it a lot over the years, but I think I'm a bit of a ritualistic sort of person, and I in a way take naturally to it, and it gave me a positive version of ritual. If that makes any sense.
So you've got quite different relationships with that.
Yeah, I remember because they had a class on a Sunday morning in Croydon where they did pujas. It was a puja class, and I had just heard about it, and I just started coming to it. I think you were supposed to be invited, sort of thing, you know, because I was still quite new, and I just turned up one day, and just did it, and I really liked it, and I didn't know anything about it. I just chanted it and just joined in, really, and I didn't really feel I needed to know about it. I just quite naturally took to it. And Padma Vajra took me aside afterwards and said, you know, I didn't know you came to this class. I said, well, I have done, you know. He said, oh, well, if you want to find out about it, so you read about it in this Mitratar. So I said, well, why would I want to read about it? He said, well, you don't have to, but if you do want to, that's how it is. So, well, I think I probably did later, but I didn't. I was quite happy not knowing about it and just doing it. And I quite liked the chanting and the reciting Pali and all that.
Mm.
Yeah. So I like the ritual element of my sadhana as well. And in a way, I do my sadhana a bit like a puja, maybe. Or I think of it that it's got that dimension to it.
Mm. And what is your sadhana practice?
Mandrakosha. Mm. Yeah.
I was just thinking we could perhaps follow that thread back into your experience of your ordination retreat, talking of ritual.
Yes.
Yeah, just wondered. I mean, I expect you've written about it, so you may not.
I haven't. Well, I did write about it, but I've taken that bit out of my
memoirs
because it didn't really seem to fit with the rest. So
it's just up to ordination, wasn't
it? I've written it up to ordination, but I haven't talked about ordination.
Mm.
Although I did write something about it, but I've kind of, it's been excised from the manuscript. But I did enjoy my ordination retreat. It was a 4-month Kukyaloka retreat in 1990. And it was very, very harmonious in my experience. I mean, maybe some people had different experience, but I wasn't aware of that. And there was something magical. I mean, it's the only word I can think of, really, to describe what seemed to happen amongst us.
A few people have said that, actually.
Yeah, because we all met after that retreat. We met every year for 10 years. We had a retreat. I think it was every year. There might have been one year when we only had a weekend. And one or other of our preceptors was there, sometimes both of them, Subhuti and Suvadra. But I think Subhuti probably was on all of them. Suvadra was in India a lot, so he wasn't necessarily there, but he was there sometimes. But nearly all of us went for a long time, for 10 years. And it just became, I don't know how it happened really, but as soon as we got together, there was this same feeling amongst us. Mm. And I kind of just took it for granted. It was only later that I thought there was something a bit unusual about it, really. And then after the 10th year, we just stopped. And we haven't had one since. We did have a reunion at 20 years. We all went back to Kukyaloka. Not all of us, I think originally there were 15 of us. I think probably about 9 or 10 of us made it back 20 years later. Mm. But I think everybody else also, who couldn't come, they did at least... you know, they replied in some way, you know, saying why they couldn't come, whatever. So that was part of, you know, those 10 subsequent years were part of my ordination retreat. Sort of, really.
Like it went on for 10 years.
It did, in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the actual ordination ceremony itself?
The private one. What I remember most about this was that, actually, this is what I remember most, but this is the most anecdotal bit of it, which was that, you know, because there was the ceremony and then Suvadra left me we had this little stupa that we spent the night in, and we spent the whole night and then 24 hours, and we didn't come out until dinner the next day. And so he went off and left me in the shrine, and I looked at, there's this ordination vase on the shrine, and I thought, and it's full of water, and I thought he's forgot to sprinkle that water on my head. He's supposed to put that on my head when he tells me my name, and he's forgotten. And I thought, well, that's all right, because I don't think he'd mind me saying Suvadra can be a bit unmindful, you know, in that sort of way. So I thought, he's just forgotten. So I thought, I'd better do it myself. So I poured the water on my own head, and I thought, that's it. I've done it properly now. That's all right. No one need know. And I didn't tell anyone for a long time. And then in the end, I was giving a talk at the centre about 10 years later, and I told them then, and I thought, now I've made it public, I'd better tell Suvadra. So I wrote to him, and he found it. He said, oh, well, that's really funny, and he said, that shows that you were very confident of your, you know, you were spiritually confident that you felt that it was all right if you did it yourself. So
So he had forgotten, it wasn't just a kind of problem.
And of course, now I found out later he hadn't forgotten. There was nothing that, but it was because actually that bit happens in the public
one, right?
So, you know, I was the unmindful one actually, but anyway, it all worked out okay.
And do you remember the moment when he gave you your name?
I do, yes. And he gave me a little bit of paper with my name on it. And as soon as I heard it, I thought, and I was really pleased. I was really pleased with it. Yeah, Satya Dharka.
And what does it mean?
Well, Satya means truth, and Dharka is a sky dancer, isn't it? So, but he said it could mean flowing truth, because sky dancers, you know, they represent free flowing energy. So, he said that was his translation. Could be flowing truth. But I always called it Sky Dancer of Truth. Although actually these days I always tend to say Flowing Truth now, because I feel I should quote Suvadra rather than claim the sky dancing archetype to myself.
And so,
you think?
So do people use in the outside Buddhist circles?
Well, I don't move that much outside Buddhist circles. Sorry, Buddhist circles. But whenever I do, and wherever I go, I am generally Satya Dharka. Although recently in my hospital visits, as I've been ill, I've allowed them to call me. I've reverted to my old name, and I feel fine about it. Whereas perhaps I wouldn't have been, but I don't feel it matters. I don't feel I've got to assert anything about it anymore. So I don't.
How about you, Savand?
Again, like, it's such a dark most of my friends are Buddhist anyway, but I tend to use my Christian name in other groups, just partly because I don't want to go in for the kind of explanations. So I use my Christian name in my writing. I think these days I would have preferred to use Savananda, but I think at the beginning it just seemed easier to use my Christian name. If I was starting again now, I think I'd probably use my Buddhist name.
Yeah, because I guess there's a real sense of continuity, because you've had a lot of work performed on the radio and things, so people know who you are in that aspect.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I know Maitreya Band has always used his kind of order name in his poetry and things. Yeah.
I just wanted to pick up something with you, because you'd mentioned that you'd Satya Dharka, because you'd mentioned that you took the Manjushri practice?
Yeah.
Manjushri, which do you...
Manjugosha.
Was it clear to you that was what the practice you were always going to want to take, or how did your relationship with that emerge?
Well, I never thought about it much beforehand, because I thought that's something to think about when I'm going to be ordained. I never really... I did have other figures. I liked Padmasambhava, and I did think it might be Padmasambhava for a while, and then... But actually, the one I liked, I felt there were various figures I thought I ought to be interested in them all, and I was thinking about them. But then I thought, actually, the one I want is Manjugosha, Manjushri. Manjugosha is a form of Manjushri, but I didn't know that then. But I did like the picture that I always saw of Manjugosha with his book and his sword. I like books and swords. So... yeah, got a sword up there, and so I did have a bit of angst about it on the ordination retreat towards the end, when I was thinking but then I suddenly thought, well, you know, it became clear to me that I wanted it to be Manjugosha, just go for that. So that's what I asked for, and I probably was also influenced by the fact that Subhuti was that's his practice, and he gave a talk about it and wrote a puja about to Manjugosha, and I think that all had an effect as well. But.
And has that connection carried on since your ordination retreat?
With Manjugosha? Yeah, definitely, yeah. I did have a brief flirtation with Padmasambhava some years later, you know, and I asked for the Padma Samba practice, and I did it for a little while, about 6 months. But then I got into, I just started to see him as this authority figure, and I felt like he was, I didn't feel at all comfortable with it, and I just went back to, I stopped doing that Padma Samba, went back to my education. I've not really wavered since, really. I don't do it every day in the way that I used to. I did do it every day for a long time, or nearly every day. You know, often I did it for about 20 years or so. And then I don't do it that fully and formally as often as I used to, but I do still do it. And I recently went on a retreat, which gave a real boost. And I felt that my sense of the practice really changed again for the better from that. And yeah, I often do it at night when I wake up, or I try to do it through the night, and often sometimes that, I mean, I just do it when I wake up, you know. I'm not sort of thinking, oh, I'm going to try and do it all night, but then often it somehow it carries on through the night, and it even affects my dreams a bit sometimes. And so, I don't know whether I'm dreaming or not.
What sort of effect do you think the practice has had on you?
I don't know. It's hard to know, is it? Don't really think like that. But I like doing it. And I turn to it in times of difficulty. And also I feel supported in it somehow. By it.
We've covered quite a lot of ground. I'm just wondering whether either of you have any questions for each other about what we've been talking about. Anything that's come up that you might want to... I mean, you've known each other for so long, maybe there aren't any questions.
Questions for each other?
Yeah, about the sort of things we've been talking about. Or anything else for that matter.
Well, I guess a question I might ask Sachidak is, how does your kind of music practice fit into your Buddhist practice? Have you thought about that much, or is it just something you do and enjoy, or is it, you know, is it part of Buddhist practice?
That's a difficult question to answer. I don't know how I explain it to myself, really. I suppose I just do it a bit like I meditate. Well, actually, a bit like the way I used to meditate, which was, you know, every day.
Right.
And it's almost like my music practice is kind of behind my meditation practice. And maybe I'm recapitulating in my music practice what I've done in my meditation practice. So that I do it quite regularly and by the book, in a way, my music practice, because it's the only way to get it done. Or certain aspects of it, you know. If you don't practice it, well, then, you know, if you don't practice your scales and your chords and stuff, well, you just won't be able to do them. That's all there is to it. You know, it's not going to happen. I used to think that just by being musical, I would get good at the technical aspects of music, but that's just not, that is not true. At least not in my case. You have to practice it and do it and discipline yourself. And I find I can do it now, whereas I didn't used to be able to do it. You know, I wasted years and years when I could have been, when I had tons of energy, when I could have been practicing every day like that music, but I just didn't. My energy was so, I'd put my fingers on the piano and I'd just start playing Boogie Woogie. I couldn't stop myself, and I would just do it until I was exhausted, you know, about 2 hours later, and then I'd stop. And I wouldn't have learned anything, really. I'd have just moved my fingers about, really. And so I couldn't. And I'd try and discipline myself. I'd try and learn something out of it. But I just couldn't, because I'd get so excited and full of energy that I couldn't actually sit still and practice anything. And I was a bit like that in other areas as well. Like, for instance, trying to read Nietzsche. I always thought I'd like to read Nietzsche. I'd get very excited by Nietzsche. And I'd read a few pages and I'd be so full of energy that I couldn't concentrate anymore. I'd have to go off and do something. I couldn't be... So there was all that. So I think it's something, I don't know. So how that all relates to, you know, Buddhism and everything, I couldn't really tell you, but I suppose something to do with integration. That's one word that I sometimes think is relevant in relation to it. Also, there's a myth. I feel there's a mythical connection. I've got some kind of mythical connection with music and the figure of the minstrel. So something to do with that, I think. But I don't know. I can't. It doesn't all tie up neatly, but there are connections. And I suppose for years I used to, you know, look back at my old diaries. You know, they're full of questions to myself and questioning of myself about whether I should do this, whether I should be doing that. Is it all right if I do this? And, oh, I'm worried that I haven't blah, 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 and all this. And is it worth, can I be a musician or can I be a poet? All that. And I just think, it's, you know, I'm 58. I've just got to do it. And I have been the last 10 years or so. And I want to carry on like that. I wish I'd taken the plunge earlier. I kind of did take the plunge, but I couldn't take the full plunge. I was worried about whether I was good enough and all that, and I almost don't care now. I just think, well, I can't help it if I'm not good enough. I'm just going to do it anyway.
I was interested in how you described that sort of parallel process between the, you know, the way that you applied yourself to meditation and so forth, and then in a very kind of systematic way, and then that transferring into the way you're applying yourself to music.
Well, I definitely think that, you know, my approach has had to be developmental, or rather I've benefited a lot from that developmental approach to things, partly because as a youth I was so opposed to it. And I just, you know, thought you just did your own thing. And that got me precisely nowhere, really. It got me into a right mess. So then I gradually aligned myself with the developmental model, which, to my surprise, has worked and has become very fulfilling in its own right. And then, but I think the thing was, I did it in the right way. I mean, I don't know if I could, that sounds arrogant. But I mean, I noticed, you know, when the whole pure awareness thing came in, which is something we haven't talked about. I mean, when was that? I mean, that's a long time ago now. But I know a lot of people, a lot of order members particularly, sort of embraced it like it was the new religion. And basically it was because they'd screwed themselves up in the way they'd meditated before that. I know that's a...
Are you talking about this?
I'm talking mainly about Savanda when I say that, obviously. But, you can speak for yourself in a moment.
Thank you.
But not just Savanda. I mean, and I wasn't particularly thinking of him actually, but there were a lot of people who they meditated in a very willful and one-sided and dry way for years, and suddenly they realised there was another way to do it, and it was obviously very, very freeing and fantastic for them, and that's great. But I don't think I did it in the wrong way in that way, because I was too... don't know why I didn't, but I was saved from that. So I think I kind of did approach the developmental model in a kind of more balanced sort of way. And so a lot of the things that they talked about in pure awareness and, you know, that sort of openness to one's experience, I thought, well, I've already got that. I've always had that in the way I approach my mindfulness of breathing and, you know, the more developmental way. I often just sit and sort of allow my thoughts to circulate or whatever. I found that actually quite affirming. And also I did benefit from all the things that I heard with people talking about pure awareness, but I've never felt particularly that I had to embrace it as a religion in its own right.
You sort of felt it was an integral part of how you approach meditation.
I felt that it was part of the way I was taught, I think, actually, or the way I received what I heard about meditation. So I can't. Now how did I get onto that? I can't remember. But anyway,
through music practice.
I know what I said included an accusation against Savon, so he'd better say something.
Not sure if the developmental thing was one-sided. Well, there's certainly an awful lot of self-criticism And I think kind of coming across pure awareness teachings as, well, taught by Tejananda, after my practice really just hit a kind of brick wall for at some point, maybe about 15 years ago. And I'd always kind of relied on meditation, and but it just went really, really dry. It was like as if there was something missing. And I think I kind of lost confidence that I'd ever be able to attain any kind of form of insight. But, you know, Tejananda's teaching at Vajraloka just kind of opened things out for me again. And so, you know, one of my main practices still is just sitting. So I found that kind of coming back to the immanence model just really, really useful. Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting now. I did the Liberation Unleashed thing, which it actually had a very profound effect on me. Not always in a kind of particularly pleasurable way, because an awful lot of difficult stuff kind of emerged from that, really difficult stuff. And I think I'm, you know, years after that, I'm still kind of assimilating what happened. And I'm not particularly interested in the whole 10 fetters thing model anymore, like sort of knocking off craving and hatred and things like that, because I think I'm still kind of dealing with what happened in Liberation Unleashed and after that, really.
So is that a kind of, is there some resonance there with like vision and transformation process of?
Yeah, I think I've always, let me put it, I think because I, you know, initially like 35 years ago, having all these kind of little insight experiences, I thought I was kind of much nearer insight and enlightenment than actually was. I didn't realise it was just kind of glimpses of vision. So I've always initially had this kind of naive idea that all you had to do was kind of switch on the light and enlightenment would be there somehow. So the whole kind of model has changed. It's much more complex than that. I couldn't understand, for example, why after some really good meditations or 2 or 3 days where you're kind of really into meditation, the next day it feels terrible or some really difficult stuff would come up. It just didn't make sense to me. It seemed a bit unfair somehow. But I'm realizing now that kind of opening up just allows the, you know, the difficult stuff to come up to be purified. And that just seems to be the cycle somehow. Yeah. So I think I've got a much more, well, less simplistic, less naive idea of insight now. But it's, you know, it's very much something that I'm very interested in. I mean, I don't go online and look at all the conversations around it. And often 2 hours in the morning is enough for me. The amount of kind of energy and things like that, it kind of stirs up. So I don't go on retreats at the moment because the last 2 or 3 I've experienced a huge amount of fear. Just the amount of energy and things like that is kind of awakened. I can't sleep and things like that. So I'm still kind of feeling my way back into retreats at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that was a bit kind of round the houses, but yeah.
So when you say 2 hours in the morning,
so. Well, that's if I sleep well enough, I try and do a couple of hours in the morning, and that's my kind of meditation for the day, really. Mm-hmm. It kind of sets me up for the day. I don't always manage that, but yeah. If I meditate too late, sometimes I find I can't sleep very well. I get a lot of energy and things like that, jerks and things. Mm-hmm. Another question for Satchidaka. When are you going to start the Buddhist novel?
A Buddhist novel?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I've got a Buddhist novel. Have I talked a lot about it?
No, you haven't. It's just a provoking question.
Oh, I see. Well, I would like to write a Buddhist novel, but I don't know if I've got it in me, or I don't know. I did used to think that I would write one, but I've ended up writing autobiography.
Mm.
And I feel as if I've used all my life experience as autobiography, and it'd be quite difficult to... I don't know. I feel as if I've used it all up.
Right.
So I don't think I'll be doing it.
Not for the time being, anyway.
Not for the time being, no. And I've got my scales to practice, so...
Okay.
So maybe not. And when are you going to write your book on Buddhism and comedy? More to the point.
Mm. Well, I shall maybe set aside an hour or two a week or something like that to start.
An hour or two a week? Is that going to be enough?
Well, it's a long-term project, isn't it?
I thought you said it would be an hour or two an evening.
No, I don't think that's going to work. I wouldn't be able to get a sleep. I did that one evening and it was so stimulating.
Right.
Yeah. So because it's not commissioned. I mean, it's an idea I've had for a while to do a book on Buddhism and comedy, but, I don't have any... I need to rely on commissions to make a living, and I don't get a lot of commissions, and something like that would be a big project, really. So it would take up a lot of time. But I think the only way to get it done is to set aside a certain amount of time every week.
Mm.
Hopefully something might happen.
Yeah. Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's more either or both of you would like to say about how your Dharma practice looks in your day-to-day life. The way, how do you know you're practicing?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, I got involved when I was about 23. So in a way, it's just like so much part of who I am. I think, you know, it's the model I've got in me that I kind of keep referring to. So I guess more and more that kind of awareness is there to refer back to in terms of behaviour and ethics and things like that. And it's less and less a kind of self-conscious thing, if you see what I mean.
Mm. Are you in a chapter?
I'm not in a chapter, no. I was in a chapter up till about 3 years ago. And... I think because I've been in it for so long, I just got bored, you know, particularly with reporting in, and we didn't kind of refer to the Dharma that much, and I just got tired of it. But I'm feeling again and need to get back to a chapter. Yeah.
Mm.
I guess that's one thing I do. I mean, we've got a kind of good thriving centre in Norwich, and I've got friends around Norwich. But the last couple of years, maybe partly because things have shifted so much to... online discussion and things like that.
Mm.
I haven't been as connected with the order or understood what's going on with the order so much, and also because it's so, you know, so complex at the moment. There's so much stuff going on. So in a certain way, I feel a little bit not alienated exactly, but just maybe not as connected as I used to be. I think in certain respects. Yeah.
Chidaka, did you want to say any more about how your Dharma practice looks in your day-to-day life?
I'm not sure that I do, really. nothing really comes to mind. I don't know what it looks like. I mean, what it looks like is a way for someone else to say, isn't it? I don't know what it looks like.
Well, you have been describing it in a way, like talking about your music practice.
Yes. I know lots of people who have music practice and they're not Buddhists, so it's not really a proper answer, me saying that, but I can't think of a better one. And I don't... Yeah, I don't know. I don't feel I can give a very satisfactory answer to it. So that's probably why I don't want to talk about it.
Well, it's interesting. Sarvananda just saying, you know, because you were pretty young when you started.
I was, yeah.
And saying it's very much kind of part and parcel of how he lived, how you live, ethical practice.
Well, I feel it's part and parcel of the way I live, but I don't know whether... I don't know that that looked any different from anybody... You know, anybody else, in a way.
You said that we've got this model that we've had for 30, 35 years yeah. that we're constantly referring back to yeah. all the time.
Yeah, that's yeah. right. I feel like I live in that, I live in within the model somehow.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that sounds like I could be very complacent, which I hope I'm not. But I feel that, you know, Buddhism is very important to me. I feel like a Buddhist, and I am a Buddhist.
So what does going for refuge to the Three Jewels mean to you?
I feel it's an ordering principle. I feel it's the context in which I work, the context of going for refuge. I feel like it's the water that I swim in, rather than this thing I do going from here to there or whatever. But I hope, I realise in saying that I could just be being like anybody else who doesn't go for refuge, and that's a danger, isn't it?
What do you think about that section, Savannah? What Satchidaka said?
I think you expressed it really well. I don't think I could improve on that, really. There's something about having the Buddha, particularly, there as a kind of example of kind of insight or enlightenment that I definitely respond to, and the reminder of community as well and friendship. I think Satchidaka said it really well. Yeah, in terms of the water you swim in.
So to look at it another way, as we've been saying, you've both been practicing for decades, you look back over the sort of landscape of that time, what matters? What do you think? What would you want? What would you say, well, in a way, maybe to somebody setting out on a Dharma life, in the light of looking back over the landscape of your own experience, what matters?
What matters in...
I don't know if this is what you mean, but recently I was looking over some of my old diaries. And it's a bit like Satchidaka was saying, like noticing all these, because I must do this, I must do that, this kind of constant, slight kind of angsty sense, especially as I was kind of beginning. In, you know, looking at the early 90s, there was all this kind of struggle and it's kind of slowly kind of lessened over the years, I think. Not that there's still not a lot of conflict and all the rest of it. But I think looking back then, that's all, I wanted to sort of advise the kind of younger me just to relax somehow, just to say, like, you're on the right path in a way. You don't have to do much except, like, really kind of relax into it and kind of trust yourself in a way. So for me, there's some kind of process of kind of relaxation and trust and self-confidence, I think. And just, yeah, really kind of connecting to others on the heart level. I think those are the aspects I'd say that is important, and that I'd want to talk to my earlier self, like give them confidence in that, you know, just to relax, have kind of self-confidence and trust your connections with people, I think. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It seems congruent with what we were talking about earlier, in a way. When we, in a way, Satchidaka, you were talking about, as you didn't use the word relax, did you? I don't know how you'd describe it, but when you were talking about not being willful, it's just quite interesting. That sense of being able to be relaxed with practice. And you'll say, yeah, that's something that you've kind of travelled to over the the decades, isn't it? And you started in different places, really, haven't you? in terms of the journey.
Yeah. Having said all that, I think I remember people didn't used to think I was relaxed. I don't think other people's experience of me was that I was relaxed. I'm not sure that I thought of myself as relaxed. I'm not really claiming to have been relaxed, but I think there was something in the way my approach to meditation, which was kind of right for me anyway. You know, it's like in that it wasn't. I didn't have a big reaction to my own practice in the way that some people have done. That's really what I meant.
Mm.
And I think there was something inbuilt in, you know, the way I approached it. A certain sort of balance or something, which at the time I perhaps thought of as a failing. I perhaps thought, you know, I wasn't, because some people would sit there, you know, totally dedicated, was I was, or they'd appear to be, you know, very concerned with concentration and everything, whereas I was just sitting with my mind really within the context of the practice. And I've always done that. So I didn't sort of bother. I was never worried by the fact that my mind was off doing other things. Whatever. I just sort of thought, if this is making sense. But I noticed, you know, teaching beginners, of course, they're all horrified by their own minds and the fact that they can't, as soon as they start trying to concentrate on their breath, they think about all sorts of other things. Whereas my experience was the same, but I wasn't bothered by it. And I just felt it was all right somehow. With some people, I feel they were somehow made to feel that it wasn't all right, or felt that themselves or something.
Mm.
And it's a tendency of people to feel that, you know, they're not doing what they ought to be doing. And somehow for me, meditation was always something that I was happy to do. But I wasn't a great meditator or anything, but it was always a good thing. Meditation has always been a good thing for me, and I've always felt it was there something for me, and it helped me in many ways, always really. Right from the start, it gave me what I hadn't had until then. That's what I want meditation to be like, that for other people, really.
Mm.
But it often isn't. It becomes this horrible chore or this oppressive thing that they can't do or whatever. But I was saved from that. I don't know why. But I do know what it's like to have I think in my music practice, to go back to that, I've experienced that willfulness, which I haven't experienced in meditation. So, when you talk about balanced effort in meditation, you sort of talk about, if you haven't got balanced effort, you often end up really tense and got a headache and, you know, all that. And I thought, I'd never had that in meditation, but I have had it in my music practice. And I've had big reactions to, you know, practicing my saxophone and then just hating it and not wanting to do it and not doing it for months and months, you know, and then going back to it and then flying into a terrible rage when I, you know, because I was trying to do stuff. I've experienced all that. I've experienced all the hindrances in a very, very vivid way in relation to my music practice, much more than I have in my meditation practice. And that's in a way, so I think there is a connection between it. They're both working on my mind. And I'm glad I had the meditation as respite from, you know, the other things my mind has.
So to go back to my question, I was asking as you look back over the landscape,
which I forgot about, presumably. Yeah, sorry.
No, you followed on beautifully from what Salvador was saying, actually. Right. I think which is part of that same thing, though. But I just wondered if there's anything else you'd say in terms of what. Oh, I said what matters, which can sound like a vague question, but it's like, as you look over the landscape, what's been important, or what would you want to communicate in a way to somebody who might be listening to this that's been significant?
Well, I suppose I've often thought recently, must be true for lots of people, you went through school and, you know, in my case, university as well, you know, and I don't remember anyone telling me anything interesting. I mean, I don't mean that in a superficial way, because obviously I was told all sorts of things, and also I was a very bad student, and I probably was told things that I don't even remember and didn't notice at the time. But in terms of my experience, I don't remember, after I was about 12, I don't remember being told anything interesting at school, anything that I needed to know. Not that I was particularly bothered by that at the time, but in effect, you know, I just, There were all sorts of things that I just could have been told, which would have helped me in my life. Mm. And no one ever said them. Not them, you know. But I feel that coming along to Buddhism and hearing Banti's lectures, particularly Banti's lectures, but also other people who, you know, have been following Banti, it was just sort of, in a way, common sense. But more than that, it was more, you know, the fact that there are truths that people can tell you. And Banti seems to be telling you certain things about the way things are. And Buddhism generally tells you about, something about the way things are. No one had... that's what I was missing before, and that's why I was so confused, because, you know, you just hear loads and loads of things, but no one tells you anything about the way things are that makes sense. They didn't tell me anything, or I didn't understand it. Mm. But I felt that that's what began when I first came along to Buddhism, to the movement, and to Banti's lectures, was that I thought, I'm onto something here. And I've tried to kind of, you know, I still feel I am. I'm still learning from that. So that's what matters.
Yeah. I think I've got to the end of my list of questions.
Yeah.
What would you be talking about if I wasn't here poking questions at you?
Well, we've got certain things that we often come back to, haven't we? What are they?
Apollo and Dionysus.
Yeah, that's one of our things.
So what is
we
it
both, that's one of the areas I think that we kind of really have connected on. Or it's like we both, how to explain, I feel that's when we most mesh with each other, is when we tune into that.
Well, that particular theme. You know.
Yeah, and the things that leads us into when we talk about it.
Right.
So who's Apollo and who's Dionysus?
Well, they're both Greek gods, aren't they? And they're often presented as a polarity between, you know, and crudely speaking, they're often equated with reason and emotion, or at least that's one of the polarities, isn't it? But we don't talk about it quite like that, do we? I feel Savanda's got a handle on it, which I've really benefited from, and I don't know anyone else who's got it quite like
Could
that.
Could I bring my image in? I know what
yes.
Images aren't very good.
It's like you can read all about Apollo and Dionysus, and, you know, Nietzsche talks about it, and other people talk about it. I've got various books about it, which I haven't read, because I start reading and I just get excited and I can't read anymore. I'm still like that. But we both had sort of experiences in our lives which we kind of relate to Apollo and Dionysus. I think that would be one thing to say. But Savanda's got a handle on it, which I feel I've imbibed from him somehow. And that's been very beneficial. Give me a handle on it myself.
So Savanna just gone off and come back with an illustration.
So this is an image of when I was going through a very, very difficult time. I think I must have been about 22 or something like that. I was kind of praying to become enlightened, and I wanted an experience, basically. I wanted to become enlightened. And I was just praying intensely for an enlightenment experience. And I got an experience, but it wasn't quite what I'd anticipated or what I wanted. I saw this kind of vision of a character almost like set in stone, like a kind of dead character. It was kind of crystallized, and it was almost like reason with no emotion. So just recently I thought it might be, you know, connect with the figures of Urizen and Orc a little bit, or Apollo and Dionysus. But and then another character who's just kind of pure mischievous energy. And they were almost like the irresistible force and the immovable object, and they can never quite meet somehow. You know, like they're defined in opposition to one another. Anyway, I saw this kind of image, and I was and I felt I was kind of trapped between the two of them, and for half an hour I thought I was going crazy. I just had this intense experience of these two kind of characters. You know, and eventually I did I think it was a Christian prayer for peace or something like that, and it kind of evaporated. But it's really kind of stayed with me. And I think why it was so useful is partly trying to get a sense of ethics and Buddhist life as a balance, as these kind of forces that you're kind of playing with, rather than kind of good and evil. You know, a sense of kind of energy and mischief and play combined with a kind of sense of order and reason. You know, the chaotic energy combined with some kind of sense of order. So that kind of polarity has been really, really useful to constantly refer back to.
Mm. And that's what you've depicted here in this image you've just put.
That's right, yeah.
Form and energy is often... Form, did you mention form? That's often... Apollo is often associated with form.
Yeah.
And Dionysus with energy. And that's important, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it was interesting, like both of us had early on, you know, before we got in touch with Buddhism, had sort of experiences of what often might seem to be pagan gods or pagan figures or something like that, kind of erupting into kind of consciousness. So I find that really quite interesting. So I do refer back to them, and I think there's a split in the Scottish character. There's a particular phrase called the Caledonian Antisigeny. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's basically the Scottish split personality. You often get all these in Scottish literature, like Jekyll and Hyde and the rest of it, you get these often very religious people who do terrible things. They have this kind of, maybe sometimes particularly religious kind of ordering consciousness, but the kind of energy kind of erupts as a kind of reaction to that in quite violent ways. And I think a lot of my writing has been around that kind of polarity. Yeah. That's the kind of thing we talk about, but it's a kind of good model that we come back to now and then. Yeah.
You mentioned your writing. You haven't said much about your writing, actually.
No.
So you say you come back to that quite often in your writing. So what do you write?
I write radio plays. So I think I've written about, I don't know how many, about 20. And that includes a comedy series I did. And I did a series of plays about a psychic detective, which were quite dark and useful for a time, but I've kind of left that behind now. I don't want to do any more of that kind of thing. Often they're kind of comedy dramas. So I just finished one about Gogol called The Tragic History of My Nose, which is a kind of tragic comedy. And again, there's a kind of split in him between a kind of... his creative genius and his more conventional religious beliefs. So that kind of leads to his tragedy, his kind of downfall, really. So I don't always know how it particularly relates to Buddhism, but it does. I try not to kind of impose a kind of too self-conscious Buddhist model on things, because it just kills it, really. But at the same time, I kind of presume that what I write's been informed by Buddhism. And the comedy I write is often most enjoyable and satisfying for some reason. You know, the pure comedy, not the comedy drama, and often that just seems like high spirits somehow, just a certain kind of exuberance. You've got to be in the right mood to do it, but... So I don't know if it's got any particularly Buddhist resonance. It's often just a kind of comes out of a kind of silly energy, I think.
But that's the sort of thing you'll be writing about when you write your book on Buddhism and comedy.
Yeah, we'll maybe be going into that in greater depth and greater detail. Yeah.
And like you were saying, that they're around that Apollonian Dionysian.
Yeah,
very polarity.
Often. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, Satchitaka, what's your experience of that when Sarvananda is writing? Do you experience those different aspects in him?
Yes, I think it's true to say. Well, the starkest difference I noticed was between Sarvananda writing the Boxer and Doberman comedy series, when, you know, there was a lot of laughter and high spirits around the house and a general humour, one could say. just the way he was, but also he'd been reading bits out of it, and it was like he would sort of seem to be embodying some of the very humorous characters and stuff that he was writing about. So that was that. And that was very, very different from the Savanda writing his psychic detective plays, which were often about grisly murders and madness and repression and perversion and all those things. And Savanda, he was very, his presence was very different when he was writing about that, shall we say. But I mean, both. But he's still. It's not like he was taken over by either of them. It was like he was. He wasn't obsessed by them or anything. It's just that he was with them, if you see what I mean. Mm. And that, you know, one couldn't fail to be aware of that living with him. And I did feel that he'd gone far enough with the grisly and dark things. And I thought it was time he got back to.
Me too.
To comedy, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm very glad about his recent career move away from the psychic detective back to.
It seems only fair to ask you, Solon, do you see the Dionysian and the Apollonian playing out in Sacerdote?
I think Sacerdote is quite an even character in many ways. I think that's why I enjoy living with him, because he's quite an even positivity, I think. And seems to kind of put difficulties into perspective somehow. So I know it's, I definitely know it's there, the Apollonian and Dionysian. I don't think I see it particularly in kind of day-to-day life. But, you know, it's obviously there. You see it in the writing and things like that. But the kind of elements of kind of seriousness and comedy. I think what I've said about such stuff is writing before, he can often be serious and he can often be comic and often at the same time, which I think is really... I know that doesn't quite equate with the Apollonian and Dionysian, but there's that, that sense of being able to be both at the same time. Yeah.
And when you're not talking about Apollo and Dionysus, any other areas?
Well, we watch a lot of comedy boxed sets.
I like to watch half an hour of comedy after my dinner. It's almost like a daily fix, isn't it?
Yeah.
But we're running out.
It's part of your routine.
We're running out.
Well, what over the years we've watched what? The Mighty Boosh, Black Books, Father Ted,
Monty Python, Arrested Development, Malcolm in the Middle. We're on to Yes Minister at the moment.
Yes Minister, Yes Prime Minister.
I've even succumbed to Last of the Summer Wine.
I haven't quite gone that far. Oh, there's Dad's Army.
Yeah,
I'm more of a Dad's Army fan.
Yeah.
This is going back a bit, you know.
I guess it's been a few years.
Yeah. Well, 18.
Yeah.
We've got through them. I've tried to get Savanda interested in 70s rock music, but I haven't really. He hasn't gone very far with it. He was never very interested in it.
No.
Whereas that was my, I was more into that as a teenager than Savanda was into comedy and radio drama, and you know, wrote to all the great comedians of the time, got very good letters back. So that's how he spent his formative years, whereas I was listening to Free and Bad Company and Deep Purple and Status Quo. And I haven't really quite got over that. I mean, in the sense of I still like them. Although I actually play jazz, which is much more refined and more serious. It's more Apollonian.
So do you think the rock music is more Dionysian?
I would say so, yeah.
So that's maybe part of how they...
Right, yeah. That's a good point, yeah.
We should probably wind up soon.
Yeah.
But anything in terms of a note to end on?
The voice of the silence.
I think we're both quite conservative in a way in terms of, you know, the order. Don't you? Sangharakshitavadins.
Sangharakshitavadins.
Yeah. I don't know if that makes us conservative, but I don't think of myself like that, but
I'm not using that in a kind of political sense.
Is there anything you thought you might say or ask or cover that we haven't?
I can't think of anything right now.
No. Well, I tried not to think about it too much. I had a couple of anecdotes which I've told, and that's about it, really. I thought it would be good if you asked us questions. That I was a bit worried that we wouldn't know what to talk about, but when you said that you would be asking us questions, I just stopped worrying.
Yeah, really, me too.
Because I have confidence that you've got a good, not so much a good eye, but whatever the...
You're able to draw us out.
Yeah.
A good list.
A good ear or something, yeah. Yeah.
So in a minute we'll have lunch. I think lunch is one of your institutions, is it not?
It is actually, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had the same breakfast, lunch and dinner for several years.
Yeah, we did. There was a time when we did have literally the same dinner every night, and that probably was for a couple of years at least. We had salad, veggie burger and pita bread. That was it, wasn't it?
Sometimes a baked potato.
Oh, and sometimes a sausage. There's one sausage and one burger. But basically, it was that. And didn't we?
Yeah.
For a long time. I don't know why we... In the end, we just loved it as well. We always loved it. So we never were bored. I remember talking to people about it. They thought it was hilarious. I realised that it was a bit odd. They thought it was a bit odd. I was very surprised. But then we stopped, and that really surprised me as well. It's like we suddenly, I couldn't think I'd ever get used to it, ever get sick of it, and then we suddenly
did.
But it's been really difficult ever since of knowing what to eat. We had to. So Savanda's been quite good at learning. He's got quite a repertoire of really nice dishes, and I've got a few, but I used to cook these enormous things because I was used to living in a big community, and I used to cook something and it would last us for 3 days. So we'd eat the same thing for 3 days in a row. Right, but nowadays we don't really do that. But I used to cook shepherd's pie and all sorts of things like that, big things. And I don't really know how to do small meals, but Savanda's very good at it.
It does sound like you're well matched. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.